Hello and welcome to the Theology Mill podcast, which is brought to you by Whipfenstock Publishers. My name is Zach Mickle. I'm on staff here at Whipfenstock, and I'm also the host of this podcast, which, as you may know, consists of interviews with leading authors and thinkers in theology, biblical studies, and philosophy. If you like the podcast, you can stop by our website at whipfenstock.com, where you can find our catalog of book publications, journal publications, and where you can also read our blog. So you're currently listening to the third episode of our Bulgakov booth, which is on the life and thought of the Russian Orthodox priest, theologian, economist, philosopher, Sergius Bulgakov. And these interviews will explore just kind of many of the twists and turns that we find in Bulgakov's biography, but also we'll be looking at some of the major themes in his body of writings. So on this episode, I talk with Sarah Livick Moses. Sarah is currently working on a dissertation at Boston College on the doctrines of Trinity and creation in Bulgakov's major theological writings. She's also a managing editor at the Journal of Religion and the Arts and serves on the steering committee for the Eastern Orthodox Studies Unit at the American Academy of Religion. And finally, she is a graduate fellow with the NU Research Initiative for the Study of Russian Philosophy and Religious Thought. So with that, thanks so much for listening, and we hope you enjoy this conversation. Okay, so I am here with Sarah Livick Moses, Bulgakov scholar and PhD candidate at Boston College. She has generously given us some of her time today to come on for our Bulgakov booth. And she comes with high praise and strong recommendation from some of the other folks we've interviewed for the Bulgakov booth. So we are sharing some time together today to talk about Sergius Bulgakov. And so we are going to kick off with our icebreaker question for you, Sarah. So if you could put three thinkers in a room all together with Bulgakov already in there and kind of listen in on their conversation, which three figures would you choose to put in the room and why?
Yeah, some of the German or Dutch mystics, the medieval mystics, maybe like Mechthild of Magdeburg, Hadewig of Antwerpen, maybe like Meister Eckhart. And that's just because I think, like, recently I've been rereading Michael Meerson's book on the Trinity of Love in Modern Russian Theology. And in that book, he kind of traces, like, some resemblances and through the textual traditions shared between modern Russian sociology and the tradition of sort of Augustinian love mysticism. And I'm not going to like try to outline some of the like historical like relationships that Meerson does. And I'm actually not totally convinced by some of his textual analysis, but I find myself as someone who has always had a great love for medieval German and Rhenish mystical theologies to wonder like what Bulgakov might have made of them, especially the women, where, if at all, he would have identified sort of Sophia in their spiritual accounts or theological reflections. How would have Hadewig and Mechthild themselves, who are quite distinct from one another, react to this like wild Russian man who is himself already in a different kind of German mystical or philosophical tradition? And I guess the researcher in me also is wondering, because like, I've not seen whether Bulgakov had really interacted with any of the women mystics. And they certainly would have had some of their texts available by the mid-19th century. So it's not totally impossible that he would have read them, but they're not sort of, he would have maybe read them, but not formally addressed in some of his analysis or genealogical tracings. So maybe like to have him respond to Hadewig's notion of the abyss or the language of divine light and mystical union in Mechthild would be really interesting for me. And then as for Eckhart, I just think that he gives him a bad rap, and Augustine for that matter as well. So I would love to just have Eckhart be able to give his own accounts and explain maybe some of the differences between their models for the God-world relationship. And also, you know, give him a chance to defend himself. Eckhart gets a bad rap in general, so.
Yeah, no, that sounds fascinating. So would you describe Bulgakov as a mystical thinker? Like, was he sort of pulling from any kind of mystical traditions himself?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think that especially in the early works and the influence of Soloviev on him, and I'm thinking in particular some of the texts in Unfading Light, the contemplative and speculative reflections he has there. I certainly think that prayer and asceticism, and have some thoughts on this for I think some of our later conversations as well, but I certainly think of him as a mystical theologian. I think Sophia is fundamentally working for him as a category of prayer. But I think in the more dogmatic trilogy, maybe it's not as apparent, but I think it's certainly important to him. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So if you could, in brief, I know that this is a kind of a large panoramic question, but what would you say are some of the main threads that are running through Bulgakov's work? Like, what are some of the kind of major themes he returns to again and again?
Yeah, I think number one would be the divine humanity, which of course you already see in some of the earlier, sophiologists or major Russian religious thinkers. And again, I think that this category for him, the divine humanity, is really about establishing for himself and for his readers what this intimate relationship between God and creation can look like, and something that is established in a kind of ontological, protological sense, instead of something that develops after the fall or after the incarnation and resurrection of Christ, or even in the eschaton. So that would be the first and foremost thing. I think in addition to that, and maybe as a caveat, eschatology is really interesting and I think significant for him, and especially how he works some of his theological categories backwards from the eschaton. And so the divine humanity is not kind of incompatible with an eschatological vision of theosis. And I think he tries to go to great lengths, though, to couch the two together and hold the tension of sort of this intimacy that exists sort of pre-eternally between God and creation, and also this eschatological vision of transfiguration, greater union. I suppose, you know, readers can decide for themselves if they think he succeeds in holding that tension. I'm convinced. I guess a couple of other categories might be sort of the iconography or iconicity. And that goes a lot also with general interest that he has in artistic creativity. And I think these are two categories, like iconography specifically and artistry more generally, which do fall under that greater category of sort of a mysticism, prayer, asceticism, action, which again, I think those themes are really quite fundamental to his theological work, but they don't necessarily get as much attention. They're more kind of scattered.
Sure.
And then finally, of course, Sophia, Holy Wisdom. And I'm sure we'll talk more about her, but that's clearly a very significant and unique part of his theology.
Yeah, definitely. No, yeah, let's go ahead and get into Sophia, because I think this is one of the more difficult or hard to understand elements, especially for those of us in the West who are coming to Bulgakov's work, or those of us who are not familiar with kind of the stream within Eastern Orthodox theology and just Russian philosophy in general of Sophia. And its use as kind of a philosophical or a theological category. So could you tell us a bit about what Bulgakov is doing when he uses the word Sophia?
Sure. I mean, I think firstly, we have to be specific about Bulgakov's sophiology being contextualized into that Russian religious thinking of the late 19th, early 20th centuries. And certainly Sophia, meaning wisdom from the Greek, is present, especially in the Eastern traditions of theology prior to this like little niche Russian circle. And so they are doing something very specific, and Bulgakov himself, of course, is also doing something different than his predecessors in the Russian milieu. But they, I think the Russian sociologists definitely imagined themselves to be drawing on a biblical tradition of holy wisdom, especially from texts, you know, like Proverbs 8:22, also traditions in the patristic texts in which the Son, the person of Jesus Christ, is often, you know, associated with this category of divine wisdom. And then, of course, there is the influence from German idealism, German romanticism, and the way that sort of Sophia world soul type language gets into the Russian tradition. So that's just a bit of background to, I guess, give a caveat or a disclaimer that it is something kind of weird and interesting happening in this particular type of Eastern Orthodox theology. But they imagine themselves to be the inheritors of something specific that is already in the tradition and is now emerging differently. And then I suppose when we're talking about it in Bulgakov specifically, I think there's kind of two sides to it. Number one, who is Sophia? Because there's a kind of like personalism that's very significant to how he understands Sophia. And also, what is sociology for Bulgakov? And I think we need to actually start with the more methodological question, the second part. And I have a quote here from this little treatise that he has on just the Sophia, the wisdom of God, where Bulgakov says that sociology represents a theological, or if you prefer, a dogmatic interpretation of the world within Christianity. It is untrue to affirm that the development of the doctrine of the wisdom of God leads to the denial or the undermining of any part of Christian dogma. Exactly the opposite is true. Sociology accepts all the dogmas acknowledged as genuine by the Orthodox Church. The central point from which sociology proceeds is that of the relation between God and the world, or what is practically the same thing between God and humanity. And that's the end of the quote. So you can see even here, right, like he's being very explicit that this method is attempting to answer this question of our relationship as human beings, as microcosms of the world, to divinity, to God. And so I think he's positioning sociology as a kind of alternative to these two opposing poles in what he sees in Christian theology, a kind of tendency towards dualism or a tendency towards monism. At the same time, who Sophia is remains just as, if not more important, I think, because he is drawing on a lot of personal experiences in his prayer life to inform this methodology, right? So Sophia is not kind of this abstract method, but it's being informed by practical outcomes of I think, what he thinks is at stake to the answer of the question, what is the relationship between God and world? And so when you're talking about who Sophia is, then there's a secondary distinction between the divine Sophia and then the way that Sophia appears in creation. And so divine Sophia is simply this category within the Trinity for him to, for Bulgakov to explain how there is an essence and how there are persons, because I think he's quite unsatisfied with the way that those categories get talked about, as if, you know, there's an essence and it does one thing, and then there are these persons and they do their thing, and then they're related in this kind of mysterious but also like maybe ambiguous or arbitrary way. So instead, divine Sophia is this way for him to describe God's essence as this eternally hypostasizable life. Yosia, the essence of God, is not sort of like a foundation behind a triune Godhead or a fourth principle, and Sophia is certainly not a fourth principle. But Sophia is instead this entirety of, again, divine life, or a divine world is what he will often say. And if divine Sophia is the inner life of the Trinity, which is kind of always for him defined by kenosis, for all persons of the Trinity, then the creaturely Sophia is sort of creation, which is able to emerge out of that kenotic Trinity, but also receive that Trinity within its being. So this is very like organic relationship between God's inner love and God's creative love. And creaturely Sophia is sometimes like defined as this gift of the Trinity, who is constantly and eternally receiving herself from the Trinity. And of course, sin, you know, comes into the picture and messes that up. And so then you get into these questions of sort of how does the creaturely Sophia manifest herself again in this different, you know, world? You have incarnation, that sort of thing. But I do think even then Christologically, what happens is Sophia becomes this way of talking about the unity of divinity and humanity in the person of Christ, because it's a singular life. And that's really important for him of, yes, we maintain sort of the Chalcedonian doctrine of defining the relationship between the natures, but how do we describe the fact that Christ was one person and had one hypostatic life? So it is a little bit technical and a little difficult, but I think that more than anything, he's interested in the in-between. And sometimes he's kind of called the theologian of the in-between, and Sophia is filling a lot of those gaps for him.
Sure. Yeah, no, that's a very full answer. And I like, yeah, you were talking about sort of the tension between monism and dualism. So is Sophia sort of a way that Bulgakov is trying to resolve the kind of dialectical tension between subject and object? Like, is he trying to kind of answer or complete German idealism? Like, does he see himself as in his use of Sophia kind of working in or fulfilling the tension in some of those thinkers?
That's a really good question. I mean, to be honest, I think there's still so much work for myself and for Bulgakov interested people to do in his relationship with the German idealists and the romantics as well. Mm-hmm. So I don't feel totally confident answering this, but my inclination is that yes, and maybe not just completing sort of some of the subject-object tensions in someone like Hegel in particular, or Schelling, really. I think it's also a correction of some of that. I mean, you see that too in his relationship to Plato or the Neoplatonists in particular. Like, I think there's sometimes when I'm reading him, I'm like, yeah, this is great. This is just Neoplatonism. Like, I'm on board. But then there's a lot of problems in those systems too, right? In the way that sort of nature and creation are necessitated and kind of emanationism that I think as a Christian who affirms certain doctrines, you become uncomfortable with. So I think that Bulgakov himself like will be quite critical of the Neoplatonists, even though you find, you know, a very strong flavor of that in his work. So I do think that Sophia, because it's both coming from this more philosophical tradition and also from sort of a scriptural, patristic, and quite liturgical foundation, it allows him to kind of hedge both. You know, I think sometimes wanting to do that doesn't always make him successful.
Yeah, no, yeah, I apologize. I know I'm putting you on the spot with that one because that was not a question I sent you at the time. But
anytime I get asked about Hegel, I'm like, so next.
Yeah, I think everybody probably does. Even the Hegel experts probably feel that way. you had talked about how he was kind of in a class of thinkers, or that there was a significant kind of history that he's working within of the sort of Russian religious thinking. So could you just say who some of those other thinkers are, and did Bulgakov know them personally, or were these just folks who he was familiar with their writings, or what was sort of the milieu that he was working with then?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think two of the most significant would be Pavel Florensky and Berdyaev. I mean, I think Regula will have a lot more to say about Berdyaev given her expertise in the area, but Florensky in particular, I think, was super significant with his pillar in the ground of truth. And, you know, he was a friend of Bulgakov's who, you know, helped him think through a lot of, you know, things in the transition that Bulgakov had from being a kind of more political Marxist activist into, you know, his conversion story and wanting to become ordained and thinking through some of those more kind of political questions in a theological vein. In a lot of ways, too, I think that the sort of antinomy method that comes up a lot in Bulgakov can be directly traced to Florensky's influence.
In your review of The Sociology of Death, which you wrote for Genealogies of Modernity, you talk about what you call Bulgakov's eschatological politicism. So what's kind of the relationship between eschatology and politics for Bulgakov? What do these two realms have to do with one another?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, and before I answer, I do just have to plug my friend Terence Sweeney, who had invited me to write that for the Genealogies of Modernity project. They do such great work. So if listeners haven't looked at them, I definitely recommend it. As far as sort of eschatology and politics in Bulgakov, I mean, very simply, I think that Bulgakov understood history, again, from its endpoints in the kingdom of God, in the eschaton, and read things back through that lens. So, I mean, for him, I think he was wondering, like, why would we define our current political interactions or failures or gain existential meaning from what's going on in this, like, horrible, traumatic, sinful reality? Is that really the, you know, source of our definitions? And I think in a certain way, he was a bit of a realist by doing so, right? History confined to its sort of current mortal and sinful state is tragic. And this is especially true for the history of Western thought in Bulgakov's mind, which he saw as sort of lending itself over time to a lot of the political violence that he himself experienced. I tell my students that one of my pet peeves is to say, you know, like when people say, oh, to err is to be human. Because for Bulgakov, and I think now for myself, the opposite is true. To be human is to become the resurrected Christ and unite ourselves to divinity through that sort of Sophianic process. And to sin, as we have politically and historically, is not human, but evil in the privative sense, right? Sure. Even demonic. Yeah. And so for Bulgakov, all political action as a Christian must be oriented towards that eschatological vision of Christ, of resurrection, of life. And all life, which I think is a really central category for Bulgakov, regardless of a person's church or religious affiliation, citizenship, immigration status, race, gender, you know, orientation, disability, whatever. I think he really believed, even though a lot of those categories were not in his mind, that every person's hope should be not here, but in what is to come. And that hope should be then inform how you act here right now. But there's one point in that, in the Sociology of Death in particular, where Bulgakov describes revelation in history as apocalypse in progress. And of course here, apocalypse being not like the end of Hunger Games where there's just, you know, like devastation and, you know, like a historical fallout. Yeah, yeah. Like the, you know, the historically Greek roots, meaning like those things which emerge from behind the veil. So that revelation is present here, even if it's from sort of a yet to come. And I think then for like specific, you know, action in the world, no one in my mind better exemplifies Bulgakov's thinking on this than Saint Maria Skoptsova of Paris, who was Bulgakov's spiritual daughter and worked as a social worker in Nazi-occupied Paris, assisting dozens, if not hundreds, of Jewish families in escaping the city and the regime by providing falsified baptismal certificates to them. And she inevitably was arrested and sent to the Ravensbrück concentration camp and ended up being killed there with some of the Jews that she had been assisting in 1945 on Holy Saturday, of all things.
Wow.
And her surviving theological writings, she was also a poet, which is worth noting. But her own theological writings, I think, indicate a very strong connection and influence from Bulgakov, who himself was quite concerned with both Russian anti-Semitism and the rise of sort of racially motivated nationalist politics, exemplified mm-hmm. obviously by the Nazi regime. So mm-hmm. I think that there's not enough emphasis that can be given to the theories and the ideas that Bulgakov had about politics and one sort of eschatological spirituality, and then the true like witness of that in his own spiritual daughter, who herself wrote quite a bit about political Christian action.
Sure. Yeah. No, that's great. Okay. So in that same article, or in that review, I should say, you talk about kind of the two poles of eschatological politicism that Bulgakov sees the church has tended towards. So what are these two poles for Bulgakov?
Yeah, I mean, at least in the Sociology of Death, he refers to one as a utopianism, which he thought tended towards, in general, a kind of like disheartening or jaded delirium. So I think, you know, the sort of retreatist type folks. And then the opposite end would be a realism, which he thought could be quite apathetic or overly pragmatic. And I think he saw that a lot in the turn towards violence and a lot of the socialist groups that he himself had helped establish, you know, leading up to the Bolshevik Revolution. So in my mind, I think that what those represent for the kind of categories that we would understand now would be like the Benedict option people, yeah, and then like super hyper secularized material Marxism. You know, one that wants to kind of reject the world, and then one that only sees the world as it is. And so I think that he kind of saw those emerging in his own context. And I think that those were kind of different than what we're maybe experiencing in a Western, like, American setting. But I still think that we can certainly see those trends, you know, happening.
Sure. Yeah, for sure. And yeah, definitely. It seems like one of the main thrusts of that book, The Sociology of Death, which we've been talking about, is kind of the church's political responsibility for the world, right? That mm-hmm. the church can't remain indifferent in regards to the world. So in your review, I'll quote a bit of it real quick. You write, that is the church's task, is instead of those two poles we just talked about, instead to participate spiritually, which always already assumes her praxis in the world, which God so loved. End quote. So what does that mean for, like, in Bulgakov's mind, what does it mean for the church to participate in the political realm spiritually? And how does it sort of navigate its way between these two poles of eschatological politicism that it's tended mm-hmm. towards in its history?
Yeah, I mean, I think to participate spiritually in these political systems, I mean, it seems to mean we should participate in systems we're already involved with our eyes open, but with our spirits awake, I think. I mean, spirituality for Bulgakov is sort of always explicitly religious. And by religious, he means, I think, ritualistic, always involved in sort of the activity of the body and the world. And for us now, I think, as was certainly the case for Bulgakov, I suppose, it also means condemning violence from within our own systems, especially our church systems, to reject violence in the name of even that of Holy Empire, and not be shy about rejecting that, even if it's from our own church. I think it means to be content with difference and learn to love others because of it without feeling insecure about that difference. I think that means that we have to kind of practice those interactions, maybe especially with those who are violent, and begin that practice through, again, prayer and ascetical attention in ourselves. I think Bulgakov was not afraid to say that there was definitely like an individual part of the life of prayer, but it's always oriented towards sort of that a canonic outpouring for the sake of others. I think in a really basic way, Bulgakov thought we needed a Christian humanism, and he wasn't alone in that within the Russian intellectual milieu. And that is a Christian humanism, I think, open to the spirit of prophecy and correction, especially within the church. I mean, I think that, I don't want to get too preachy here, but I think we all have a little bit of Dostoevsky's Father Ferapont in ourselves. You know, we literally become the people who sneer at the cross and say, aha, you know, when our opponents fall or they make a mistake, whatever side of the political spectrum or you find yourself on. And I think to interact spiritually in political systems, we have to ask ourselves and be able to stop to consider what's at stake for whatever our supposed opponents are. Why might they consider us a threat for their own well-being? Right? Like, those are really difficult and vulnerable questions. And I don't think that it means that there's sort of like compromises you make. I think that Bulgakov would be appalled by those who support the invasion of Ukraine, for example. But I think that being vulnerable and humble enough to ask the question of why that's happening is still significant for him, because to react in kind without those questions is to again perpetuate that cycle of tragic history that he's already living and concerned about.
I don't think that's too preachy. I think it's really, really good. You brought up the situation with Ukraine and Russia, and that's something in your own work that you've sort of applied Bulgakov's eschatology and his political theology to that situation, which is unfolding today, of course. More specifically, you kind of map a Bulgakovian framework in one of your articles onto the position of Patriarch Kirill of Moscow. So could you speak a bit to how Bulgakov's framework for eschatology and politics proves helpful in sort of understanding some of the political maneuvers that the patriarch has made?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I don't want to pretend that I know Kirill's intentions or have any insight into what his prayer life looks like or his, you know, motivations, because who knows what's happening behind the walls of the Kremlin, to be honest. Right. But I will say, from the language he uses in very public speeches and from Bulgakov's framework and my own evaluation, I think the language he uses is representative of a very violent utopianism, if we're using the kind of poles that we established from Bulgakov's, you know, system. And I think the difference between the violent utopianism I see with Kirill and Russia at the moment, as opposed to the kind of retreatist version that we described or saw in The Sociology of Death with Bulgakov, is that sort of instead of the retreat from the world into a kind of anarchist religious community, which in many ways I wish that was the choice they make, so that would be more beneficial for all involved parties. But I think that the kind of violence that we see, it's valuing, instead of retreat, a sort of forcible establishment of empire, which comes with the subjugation of dissenting parties to their utopian vision. It's still unclear to me exactly like what Kirill's relationship is to Putin and who is sort of pulling more of the ideological strings. But from the theopolitical standpoint, the violence and the violent spirit of that we saw in the socialist revolution in Russia had the same desire to force conformity. And I think that that desire was already present in the feudal halls of Tsarist Russia and the empire that we saw there. So I guess I'm seeing Kirill's actions as sort of downstream from a lot of history of holy war, a lot of sort of historical and communal trauma. And then I think that language of holy war is being used and quite literally weaponized by Putin. So I think it's very much I know there's a lot of debate among, you know, scholars who have a lot more expertise in Russian politics than I, who don't think that it's, you know, a religious war. And I'm not interested in necessarily making a stand of whether it is, but I certainly know that the theological language is being employed to help whatever the true motivation is. And I think that violent kind of utopianism is devastating.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, in Bulgakov's own day, what are sort of the actual religious poles? So when he talks about kind of these two religious poles of you know what you described as utopianism and retreatism, what's sort of the concrete manifestation of those in his day, if there are, what are the entities, I guess, that he's actually talking about when he's referring to those?
That's a really interesting question. I think the realists that he talks about are certainly like the sort of socialist Marxist movements that, again, he had been involved in the development of a lot of these sort of parties and revolutionary factions during the social unrest at the end of the Tsarist period. As far as the utopianisms or the retreatists, I think that it's a little bit more complicated. I think there's certainly like the sort of monastic groups, especially those who were kind of at the Optina monasteries, who had a lot of pull with the ecclesial powers. And I know that, you know, Bulgakov was quite disappointed by the lack of ecclesial response to a lot of the sort of economic failure, the plight of, you know, the lower class people in Russia. He just didn't feel like there was enough kind of like social interest, which I think is one reason he had hoped so much of the revolutionary parties would be the answer until he realized how violent they were becoming. And, you know, I know there were also quite a lot of reforms that him and others in the institutional church were trying to push, and those were came to a quite stark halt at the behest of St. Nicholas II Romanov. So I think they are the utopians in the sense of retreat, but not in as significant or like obvious way as, like, you know, we might see with like the Benedict option. No.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So then where does Sophia come into all this? Cause I know that we had discussed earlier, you provided a really nice description of what Bulgakov's doing with the idea of Sophia, but when it comes to, not just the church and the world in kind of a more general sense, but specifically, how does his sociology shape kind of his idea of the church's political witness within the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think Sophia's mediating capacity that we saw in like his Trinitarian theology and in his Christology is just as present in some of these questions around politics and sort of ecclesial action, because the church is in the world and also not the entirety of that world. I think to live and sort of embody her calling in that creaturely aspect of Sophia, because Bulgakov will often talk about the church as the creaturely Sophia, means that she has to recognize that ambiguity and again become that in between, neither becoming the world nor abandoning it. I think the witness of the church has to always pass the litmus test for Bulgakov of whether or not her actions serve that eschatological union, which is so important to him. And I think that what that means is, does the action of the church or the people in it foster life for others or not? You know, beyond survival, like what is the church doing to make sure people can live? And that includes, you know, body, spirit, freedom, all of these categories that I think underpin a lot of Bulgakov's political interests. And I think Sophia necessitates that we care for the world, again, opposing this kind of desire to retreat or subjugate the world. You have to care for the world because Sophia has already, the system of Sophia in Bulgakov's mind has already established that the world is from God and good. And so then to recognize the kind of eternally saturated presence of divinity in the world, to see holy wisdom in every person and in all places, even in the places that are the most broken, you have to recognize that, like, the church cannot recast the world in her own image in, like, a prideful defensiveness. God is just fine. How is the neighbor? I feel like that's the vibe here. Like the world is from God, and God loves that world, and we are invested in that. And we have to be allied with life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, you wrote a really wonderful paper, which you sent to me in advance of our conversation, that you presented at the 2019 Bulgakov conference in Freiburg, Switzerland, where there were a lot of other really seminal Bulgakov scholars. And so in that paper, you're presenting kind of a feminist retrieval of Bulgakov's theology of icons, which you've talked a bit about iconicity already. But in that paper, you're also presenting kind of a critique of some of the ways that gender difference actually inscribes itself within Bulgakov's dogmatic project. So could you speak to what role gender difference does play in Bulgakov's theology, and especially, because I know this is a big part of your paper, and kind of his figuration of the Trinity?
Sure. To be honest, a lot of the details around gender in Bulgakov are things that I'm still working on and working through in my own thinking. But I will say, I think on the level of Trinity, at least, especially in some of the distinctions that he'll make between the Son and the Spirit in the economy, you can find a lot of, I guess, traditional language around activity and passivity used or justified by, like, gender distinct roles of the person. So, for example, the Son being the more active as the Word and its very kind of masculine role, where the Spirit takes on sometimes, like, this more passive or sometimes, like, transparent feminine mood. And it seems for now, I think it's a lot more complicated than just, like, those traditional roles with the way that Sophia becomes present, because she has the status of divine world, divine life, and is hypostasized as all three persons, including the Father, and therefore is associated with some of these gendered categories when Bulgakov is talking about, like, kind of economic presence, but is also entirely beyond gendered language, which of course is always symbolic anyway when speaking about God. And then there are some passages on creation that I find very fascinating, where Sophia is both the womb of productive nothingness from which creation emerges and in which God creates, but is also the Trinitarian God who is doing the creating. So it's this very, like, I think, reciprocal relationship between, you know, those categories of activity and passivity, which I just don't think they hold all the time. Yeah. Then, of course, that has implications, and this is more what my paper was about. There's implications about those more gendered references to the Son and the Spirit with Bulgakov's anthropology, you know, because he'll say, on one hand, that every person is made in the image of the Trinity, and so they have sort of all of these kind of Trinitarian aspects to human persons. But then he'll also kind of make comments of, like, oh, well, but, you know, men are, like, a little more of the Son and women are, like, a little more of the Spirit. And you're like, yeah, okay. It doesn't seem like it's that helpful or important to the anthropology, because the icon is the, like, major significant category that doesn't rely on those terms. So I think there's a lot of interesting work to be done there. Certainly something I'm going to continue to pursue. Mm-hmm. But I think also the question of, like, divine femininity in the ancient Syriac Christian tradition and what they do with wisdom might be helpful and fascinating to think through with Bulgakov. And of course, Sophia is also a category for a lot of modern feminist theology. Rosemary Radford Reuter and Elizabeth Johnson in particular will talk about holy wisdom explicitly in feminine categories, but neither of them or many others, except those who read the Russians, make kind of any reference to the sophiological tradition, the Russian sophiological tradition. And I think people like Bulgakov and Soloviev are just like begging to be, you know, engaged in that. So definitely a lot more to be done there.
Sure. And now this is sort of a side question, but is Jennifer Newsom Martin, is that sort of what she's up to as well? Because I know she's working, you know, she has worked with a number of figures, but Balthazar, I think, is who she wrote her dissertation on, but kind of the Russian, his use of Russian religious thinkers. So I know she's really interested in Bulgakov as well, and in French phenomenology, but it seems like she's likewise doing kind of a feminist retrieval of these figures. Am I correct in thinking that?
Oh, for sure. I think her work is excellent. And a lot of it, of course, is filtered through her work on Balthazar. So I'm not sure like what her future projects will look like. Maybe she will do something explicitly on one of these thinkers. But she has that essay in Modern Theology, I believe, where she talks about like the whence and whither of gendered language in Balthazar, which, you know, she sees him picking up some of this from Bulgakov in particular. But I think also, you know, so much with Balthazar is with the Adrian von Speyer and the relationship there. So, I think that she is doing a lot of that work though.
Sure. Okay. So, yeah. So, I mean, we've talked a bit now about kind of the way that gender difference figures in Bulgakov's dogmatic work, but within that paper of yours, you're also kind of drawing on what you would call his kind of more fundamental iconology, which opens up kind of a series of resources for what you say is a more liberative anthropology, perhaps more liberative anthropology with I don't know, kind of a feminist slant or something. Could you say a bit about how Bulgakov's theology of icons lends itself towards that kind of feminist unfolding that you're performing in this paper?
Sure. I mean, I'm going to get a little bit on a soapbox here, but I honestly think like some of his more problematic references to like complementarianism in his anthropology feels really lazy to me, because I don't think that was really what he was interested in as a question. Like that, I think he was saying things that made sense to him, but I don't think he really cared to ask a deeper question around this in particular. I mean, the anthropology he presents us does not seem, with very few exceptions, to have any ontological interest in gender roles or distinctions beyond like symbolic ways of thinking about Trinitarian persons. And that's kind of what I was referencing earlier with like the sun being associated with men and like the spirit associated with women. And of course he's not even beyond the binary of, you know, sexed men and sexed women. So I'm not trying, I think, to like defend or justify him on this, especially when he makes comments that particularly about Eve, which are really truly distressing to read from an author that I love and admire so much. Right. But I think it's more that when he says the divine humanity includes all humanity as an icon of the Trinitarian Godhead without boundary or exception, when he says that, I believe him, you know, and I think that makes me want to hold him accountable to those more serious theological conclusions that he's making than these arbitrary moments of like misogyny, really, that just don't seem to have a lot of weight in playing out through his theological thinking. But I guess to answer your question from the paper that I gave, I think, you know, I was working mostly about his understanding of kenosis as an essential activity of the Trinity, which I mentioned already before, that, you know, it's not sort of the exclusive personal property of the Son. But his thinking on kenosis opens up and influences, you know, a lot of how he thinks about what it means to be human and living, you know, iconographically or living in a kind of iconicity. So I think kenosis and icon are very sort of linked here. And of course, I'm aware of also like the feminist critiques of kenosis. But I think it seems clear to me that this solitary I-ness, which can never be iconographic, because to be an icon indicates you know that there is something of which you are an icon. Whereas to establish yourself as an idol is to say that you are the solitary I, the subject without object, which Bulgakov refers to as satanic. Like he really thinks of that kind of cold individualism as anti-human. And I think that that's what patriarchy does. And I think that's what Bulgakov's own definition of kenosis and the self-giving father stands in opposition to. So people have to be able to affirm their own hypostatic reality, obviously in an individual kind of way, in order to give it for another person. But that's always the end. And I think that that's a really powerful kind of self-affirmation. What seems to be more patriarchal to me is to try and hold on to that power over others. Whereas like living iconographically is to know that one has such a depth to give. And I don't think that that's a kind of like anti-feminist annihilationism or like renunciation of the self. Because I think it's pretty powerful to know you're the icon of the eternal life-giving depths of the Trinity. And that's, I think, what Bulgakov wants all people to know about themselves, that one's proto-image is this God who loves you and wants you to also be eternal.
Sure, sure. Yeah, no, that's beautiful. What's next for you? Are you, I know that you're in the midst of all the busyness and chaos of your PhD program and probably working on your dissertation, but what's kind of on the horizon for you professionally and in terms of your own research and writing?
Sure. So spoiler alert, I'm writing on Bulgakov. my dissertation is basically on Trinity and creation in Bulgakov's writings. And I am giving a kind of explicit focus to the role of Sophia for an Orthodox spirituality on the themes of gender and iconography. I'm hoping that kind of work will expand later, obviously into more intersections. And also have a very like vested interest in what his Mariology can do, but for now, it's Trinity and creation. And I'm also working on some projects on sort of mystical theology and dialogue with French psychoanalysis. And then I have some, you know, other projects going on with Orthodox spirituality and trauma theology. So lots of things in the works under review. Yeah. But
okay. Yeah. All sounds fascinating. Where can our listeners find more about you and about your work?
So you already mentioned my review of the Sophiology of Death in Genealogies of Modernity. I have a shorter notice of the same work in Theological Studies, actually. It's not super exciting, you know, it's just kind of a little notice because I think it's a great translation. Yeah. It's a really important text. My piece from the Freiburg conference that we talked about on iconographic anthropology is actually going to be published, hopefully by the end of the year, in an edited volume with the German publisher Aschendorf Verlag. Thankfully, my good friend Regulus Wallen has been doing most of the work for that. She's been amazing, so shout out to her for that. I do have a poem published in Macrina magazine, if poetry's your thing. And other than that, you know, just some conferences coming up, teaching for the new year, and applying for jobs. So
awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Sarah. This has been a really wonderful discussion. I've had a good time.
Thank you, Zachary. I appreciate it. Yeah.